I think that there are infinite possibilities that will enhance the prospects of business going forward. But again, it's incumbent upon any executive to know as much about this as possible. Whether they fancy it or not, it's coming.
It's true in tech as well as everywhere else, money talks. So with GenAI impacting every industry, it is certainly shaking up the world of finance. Today, we're joined by Ron Insana, CEO of iFi AI and longtime CNBC contributor, someone who has had his finger on the pulse of finance and technology for a very long time. Ron, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, David.
All right, let's dive right into it. How has GenAI changed the financial services industry to better help financial professionals?
Well, it's another in a series of major technological changes that has taken place since I started in the business in 1984. So you can imagine if you were in a financial newsroom or you were on a trading desk back then, we were dealing with newspapers, we were dealing with wire services that came over on rolls of paper, we were dealing with script sets that you ripped up. And when you were on a trading floor, you were also dealing with paper. If you saw a buy order come in, it was a group of runners who had paper tickets who spanned out across the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. There was very little electronic trading activity, which obviously over time evolved into computerized trading, evolved into all kinds of different types of algorithmic trading. And now with generative AI, while it's not fully used yet for the investment management process, it is helping to create productivity and efficiencies, efficiency enhancements, in back office activity right now. So whether it's meeting notes, whether it's reminders for dealing with your clients, whether there's cash coming in and it alerts a financial advisor, for instance, to the fact that there's a, you know, there's a pile of money coming in that needs to be deployed. Right now, we're in the early stages of applied artificial intelligence in the financial services sector. So it's really kind of in very, very early on in terms of handling logistics, in terms of handling back office activity. And we at Quantum Street, which is the parent of iFi, are more at the forefront of it, the investment management process, which we think over the next 5 to 10 years is going to be, if not completely overtaken by AI with respect to the investment decision-making process, it's certainly going to become increasingly important in that regard.
You touched on it a bit. You're talking about like productivity, the tedium of meeting notes and summarization and setting reminders. How else is GenAI involved currently in the financial industry?
Well, most of the major firms, and so imagine first that, you know, they're all using quantitative solutions when it comes to, you know, managing money. They're using algorithmic trading. You know, all of that is part and parcel of what's going on in the marketplace today. And they're experimenting really with artificial intelligence as a tool for either enhancing or ultimately making investment decisions. We're also, at our firm, creating indexes. We're creating components of indexes that are used by large banks, in which they then look to their quantitative investment solutions teams to sell various types of products, whether it's an ETF, exchange-traded fund, or whether it's an index that might go into a fixed indexed annuity that we've designed through our AI process, which I can get into in more detail later. And so you're starting to see product development also emerge with artificial intelligence as the engine, if you will, for creating either new indexes, new exchange-traded funds, or other new investment products. Even structured notes and things like that are using AI as the engine, if you will, for creating new opportunity sets.
So a big part, and I think obviously everyone's thinking about it, is we want better estimates and forecasting, right? Do you think that GenAI has the capacity to do some of these like scenario building and modeling as opposed to what we usually use in traditional machine learning?
So that's exactly what we're doing, actually. So using deep learning models on WatsonX, we analyze 50,000 global publicly traded securities every single night. We read 1 million news articles in 30 different languages, and then run 120,000 models per night to create expected rates of return on all those individual securities and on some exchange-traded funds as well. And in the institutional space, they're looking for one-month forecasts. So whether it's, you know, for a product where they use the data to plug it into the ETF that they've created, or whether they create an index around this, we have 1 month and 3 month expected rates of return on these 50,000 publicly traded securities. And we can, like I said before, create indexes, or if you're a purchaser of individual stocks, you can look at on Quantum Street, and particularly on our advisor platform, you can look at all these expected rates of returns. You can get generative AI summaries that explain that process. you can get confidence scores that give you a really a historical analysis of how accurate these forecasts may very well be going into the future. Where we're not quite, I think, fully developed is creating long-range forecasts. Because you know, as you know, as you're taking in a million news articles a night in real time, to look out past 3 months, you'd need some news that was coming in of very high quality that had also high quality predictive value. And so that's a little bit more challenging, but certainly over a 30 or 90 day horizon, that's something that we've been engaged in now for quite some time.
That was the next thing I was going to ask. I was going to say, okay, so you have obviously all these news articles, but how do you separate the wheat from the chaff when you're feeding information that's so variable like news articles? Like it could be the author, it could be the publication. You're not always going to get great data. Are you doing any like filtering with the news articles you choose?
Absolutely. And you know, Watson helps with that because with the governance programs that they have on WatsonX with respect to quality, with respect to a whole host of other issues. And we, of course, have some proprietary tools ourselves. And we gravitate towards higher quality articles that, you know, we know come from trusted sources. So there are trust readings or ratings, if you will, on the news sources. Now, occasionally you're going to get a bad piece of information that comes in from a smaller outlet. And it might be, quite frankly, totally meaningless, but it'll pop into the generative AI summary just because it may have been circulated a lot, even though it was something quite small that doesn't necessarily have a market or individual security impact. So we continuously train and retrain the models and look for different sources and higher quality sources of news and information to put into these models so that we know we're getting the best possible news we can. We have, you know, obviously scraping tools as well that go across a wide variety of different news sources so that we're trying always to capture the highest quality and most impactful information that you can get across a wide array of sources, whether it's newspaper, internet, social media, what have you.
Could you have ever imagined that you could do something like this? When you're on the trading floor and you're working with paper tickets, could you have ever imagined doing something like this?
Well, so I started more on the journalism side, and which was really, you know, running in parallel with what was going on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange in the 80s and even the early 90s. So again, yeah, I mean, when you were dealing with paper in the early days, and we would buy our own newspapers, right? Go into the office. We would read as much as we could before we went on the air to talk about what was happening in the financial markets. And our counterparts who were actually engaging in the transactions were doing virtually the same things, right? And like I say, if you had an order, it came in over the telephone. You know, the broker would then turn to the runner. The runner would deliver the trade to the other side, you know, and this would literally physically take place on the floor of an exchange. And what we thought was fast at the time was as fast as they could possibly go. You know, if you remember in The Wolf of Wall Street, the pneumatic tube that they, you know, shoot the order down, that was part and parcel of the entire process. And then as you moved into the mid-80s, computers were increasingly used for different types of program trades, for instance, that were done in larger and larger scale after having been done by hand. One of my sources on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange in 85 and 86 used to call me up and would say, such and such a firm has a buy order coming, and it would be a couple of guys coming down with boxes of tickets, and they would fan out across the floor, and you could literally see it coming. And then it was computerized, and you would still, there were ways to see it coming, but not visually, not that way any longer. And so, no, I mean, in those days, it was hard to envision even having computers in the newsroom. That didn't happen until, you know, the early 90s to use them in any meaningful way. They were used in the 80s on various exchange floors, but they were generally handheld, and they would help traders do some calculations if they were options traders, for instance, right? And you were trying to use the Black-Scholes model, which is a way in which you price options. There were guys who would have like a handheld tablet that would help them do the math, but nothing that was integrated fully into the system that would allow for transactions to take place. So more and more as that electronic trading emerged, it got more and more sophisticated over time. You had quantitative models, then you had algorithmic driven trading, and now, you know, then machine learning, and now artificial intelligence getting into the game as well. And so, look, I mean, the speed and the power is going to expand exponentially. And I think that's another, and we've dealt with that with each iteration of new technology, but it's something we'll have to deal with again.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, everything's changing day to day. Even like I'm an engineer, so like I'm seeing it from the ground, but I can't imagine what it's like. And to be honest, machine learning has been a part of investing for a pretty long time at this point.
Yeah. Oh, for over 40 years, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but what you're talking about is a tremendous step. And so do you think like AI-based trading is performing better than the older tactics?
I don't think we're there yet to make that determination. I don't think it's fully integrated yet. And so I think, you know, there's going to be a lot of experimentation that's done. I can see how it certainly can be. I mean, as we look at the theoretical limits of accuracy, for instance, right? We know that the theoretical accuracy limit is about 80%. We strive for 70% directional accuracy in the expected rates of return. Don't believe we've hit that across the board, but if you can get to a level where your forecasts, whether they're short-term or long-term, have a accuracy score in true terms, I mean, where you're really accurate with very small error rate and you're over 51%, and quite frankly, if you're over 60%, you're going to do better than any human can ever do, right? So if you think about the hedge fund community or any other kind of professional investing environment, if you're right big 51% of the time and you're wrong small 49% of the time, you're a billionaire, right? you're going to be extremely successful. So if you can get that accuracy score with a great degree of confidence up into that, in and around that level, AI is going to be truly transformational in the way in which investors operate going forward.
Well, how do you believe that we can effectively train AI to maximize its ability to invest?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, the models have to grow and learn still, right? So there's training and retraining that needs to be done. The quality, again, like any other computerized, if you will, process, it's still a question of garbage in, garbage out, right? I mean, the quality of the data has to be sufficiently high that it becomes increasingly reliable. And one of the other things that we're going to have to learn to live with, as we have in other periods of technological advancement, is will artificial intelligence, if it's used by multiple players in the business or predominantly by the entire industry, will they all start doing the same thing at the same time and start to match trades? And in which case, you'll add liquidity, as they always say they do when a new technological development takes place. And then at some juncture in the future, and this is the worst case scenario, they'll all make the same mistake at the same time and create some market mayhem. So we've seen that happen with computerized program trading. We've seen it happen with quantitative issues. We've seen it happen with algorithmic trading. So we'll have to see. I mean, we're hoping, again, that systems are developed that can analyze, learn, and learn from their own mistakes, right? When you talk about things like back propagation, learn from their own mistakes and use historical analysis and other types of, you know, kind of deep learning to self-correct, that it becomes an increasingly reliable tool over time to make those accurate forecasts. So it's not fully deployed yet. So it's really hard to say that, you know, anybody's out there killing it with AI. Everybody's out there experimenting with AI to see if they can reach those levels of accuracy that would really enhance the investment process.
I feel like once you have one successful use case, once you have one successful company that has shown success, it's going to be transformative.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've had some good success with it. Like last year, for instance, our expected rate of return on the S&P 500 over, you know, a 1 month rolling, 30, you know, 1 month rolling periods, right? We were, I think, 83% accurate. And we missed two windows. We don't expect to hit those types of levels of accuracy every year. It would be unusual. But again, if you get up around 70%, you're doing better than most people can do.
And I feel like you're talking about backwards propagation. If you're talking about like these novel and singular events that happen, it will be trained to forecast it in the future. It would be look for something very similar. And I know that's not always going to happen, but it will eventually have I believe, right?
Yeah, one would hope because people are so wildly fallible in this, right? I mean, every time we have a market event that is catastrophic, it's just dressed slightly differently than the prior market event that was catastrophic, right? So in my career, we had the 1987 stock market crash, which a lot of people could see coming, right? And then we had a mini crash in 89. Then we had some events in the 1990s, like the Asian currency crisis in 1997. You had the Russian debt default and long-term capital collapse, big hedge fund in 98. Then you had the collapse of the internet in 2000. And just 8 years later had the collapse of the housing market and credit market. Each one of these things has very, very similar features. But as I say, they, to borrow an expression from Macbeth, you know, they're dressed in borrowed robes, right? They're wearing different clothing. And so people fail to recognize the similarities. And so what we're hoping is that, yeah, I mean, if artificial intelligence meets its goals, it will understand that those events are shaping up to be similar, and then offer direct investments in the manner that would be befitting of getting out of the way of a major crisis before it happens.
So a lot of these tools that you're mentioning, they're used by financial organizations, they're used by big companies. What is stopping someone like me from going out and using some of these tools myself?
Nothing.
I could just go and use it.
If you can afford what it takes to, run a couple thousand models every night, and do the same type of thing that, oftentimes takes, millions of dollars to do on a serial basis.
So money, we're talking about millions of dollars. I can't do it.
Yeah. So look, we were contemplating a retail product, right? That offers these same things, right? So the expected rates of return, transparency around the, signals that drive the expected rates of return, the signal attributions. And you're going to see this increasingly with a lot of the firms that deal with self-directed traders like yourself. They're going to start offering tools, whether it's our own and we, cut a deal with somebody, or whether they develop them independently. These tools are going to be made available, much like any other, advancements have been made available to individual investors over time. And you'll be able to, go on your whichever account and utilize whatever they're offering to enhance your returns. So rather than develop these things yourself as an individual, you're going to wait for, one of the houses with which you do business to offer those tools on your, on the site that you go to, and within your account, you'll have access to those tools, just like you do now with, whether it's Robinhood doing commission-free trading or, coming up with other types of offerings. That's likely the direction in which the industry will go.
Well, once these tools become also more democratized and they're available to people like me, financial service institutions need to maintain their competitive edge. How are they going to be able to do that?
So this is interesting. I mean, there's a lot of talk about this, is it going to drive the financial advisor out of business, or is it going to replace the chief investment officer? We still view these tools as assistants, if you will. But what we also view them as is productivity enhancers, efficiency enhancers that will allow advisors and others to spend less time on the investment process, less time on back office, and more time utilizing their soft skills to build and deepen their relationships with clients, right? And also increase wallet share with existing clients and increase the size of their book by having time to go out and get new clients. So, and I think that's the way the industry is looking at this, is anything that relieves individuals of more mundane, and that's the case in the case of back office work, or even more sophisticated work like investment management. But if you can relieve them of those obligations to a certain extent, right, there's always going to be some responsibility on the part of the advisor or the investment professional. But still, when you want to build a book of business, you want more time. You want to deepen the relationship you have with your clients, because there's so many different things that they require. It could be anything from paying bills all the way out to buying airplanes, depending on how wealthy your client is, or arranging for travel and, becoming, one-stop shop, financial shop for your high net worth client. The way firms are looking at this right now is, how do I reduce that amount of time that my employees spend on things that can be, and we've done this through several different iterations, with the internet and other tools that have become available. How can we reduce the amount of time spent on, I wouldn't say low quality jobs, but I would say low quality priorities, things that they, just to use ChatGPT for an example. I mean, you can have notes written to your clients. You can have the meeting notes that I talked about earlier, all these different things that are, you can utilize as a tool that then somebody just kicks that out to your client, assuming you've cleared compliance with all of this. It just gives you more time to do what would build your business, make it more productive, and make it more profitable.
You could have a smaller team do bigger things, right?
Yeah, you can. I mean, but you can also have, the same size team do better things, right? And so that's the other part of this is, higher quality interactions, more customer support, more interpersonal engagement. All of that means a lot in the type of business that, we look at when it comes to financial professionals. The interaction with your clients is extremely important, and the quality of that interaction becomes important over time as well, because in a lot of instances, you're dealing with generational wealth, particularly when you get into the high net worth category. And so there are a lot of different things you have to deal with, including, family trauma, both happy and sad events, making sure that estate plans are taken care of, making sure that the kids are, you know, funded for school. That may not be automated. Some of it might be, the investment process might be, but the interactions, the advice, and a lot of the handholding during periods of intense market volatility is something that you can do when you're less concerned with some of those other responsibilities.
That's really interesting, like thinking about the personal connection between the advisor and their clients.
Well, across the board, I mean, when you start talking to people who are, you know, looking at this in slightly different ways, and it's funny because, you know, we've gone through this whole period where, you know, STEM education is extremely important, right? Everybody was going to be a coder, except now AI is doing the coding, right? So the kids who are in, you know, getting computer software degrees, you know, or computer science degrees in college are now starting to look around for jobs going, oh, these guys don't need me. And so what happens is that some folks who observe the landscape these days are saying that soft skills are going to have a premium. And it's not the way we thought about this in any way, shape, or form. But when you look at a lot of businesses, whether you're a lawyer, a doctor, you know, a financial advisor, yeah, you're going to have all these tools available to do things that, you know, you probably didn't want to do or you wasted time on. Or if you're particularly in the field of medicine, I mean, if you have an assistant that it is an AI-driven analytical tool, it increases the amount of time you can spend with patients, right? So again, these soft skills become increasingly important. And some people think that those will command premium dollars as the other aspects of your business become commoditized.
Yeah, no one could have seen that coming. Honestly, no one could have, especially like...
Yeah, no, I know. I was, in fact, I think it was at IBM when Seth Dobrin, I believe it was, who was talking about this. That soft skills are going to be really important. And so, you know, we've gone from trying to train our kids to be, you know, math heads and computer scientists. And now we're saying, hey, you know, maybe you better brush up on your interpersonal skills because you're going to need those more.
All right. So financial teams are moving at, like, with their innovation at a breakneck speed, especially when Gen AI. How do you deal with concerns around cybersecurity and data privacy?
Well, so there's a lot. I mean, this is going to be, I think, to a certain extent, one thing that will slow the adoption rates down when it comes to things like investment management, because there are compliance issues and there are roadblocks in that regard. And there are concerns about privacy. There's concerns about cyber in the sense that once you upload, and there might be some clients who don't want this, right? I mean, if their personal data is in the cloud somewhere being analyzed, they may have some reticence. I think there's going to have to be a hard infrastructure built around compliance, data security, privacy issues, and things like that. You know, if you're worth a lot of money, you don't want those numbers floating around. I mean, even if you're not worth a lot of money, you don't want those numbers floating around. You don't want anybody to be able to access that. So I think there is an ongoing discussion about this, and we see it in the marketplace as well. It's like, you know, my compliance guys may not want me to use and they incorrectly view this as a, you know, push button system, because where does legal liability fall? Is it the data provider who's like us, who's, you know, giving expected rates of return? Is it the wealth manager who decides to use it? And so there are all questions around liability issues as well that are emerging and that, you know, won't stop it, but will probably at least slow down the adoption. What can happen very quickly, and what is happening very quickly, is the back office tools. No one's got any objection to that. Although it's interesting, I was talking to an advisor a couple of days ago about meeting notes. And let's say the meeting notes are taken, but something happens where the investment is not executed properly, and you've got meeting notes that are accurate, but you've got a mistake somewhere in the investment process, you've just opened the door to legal liability, because those meeting notes are available to both the client and the advisor. And so, there are going to be a lot of kinks in the system for a while until we figure out, you know, how all these questions will either be handled or ultimately adjudicated. And I think everybody needs to be cognizant of the fact that, you know, you don't have to rush. There's time to learn how to integrate these systems into your own and use them to your advantage and to your client's advantage. But, you know, the sprint can always be dangerous. We found that out during the internet days. We've found it out in a wide variety of ways when every time we've had a technological revolution of sorts, there have been some potholes along the way that need to be, you know, refilled as we travel down that road.
Do you anticipate a time when there won't be a human in the loop?
I don't. I mean, for a wide variety of reasons. I mean, not the least of which is people need purpose, right? So on both sides of the transaction, right? I don't see how that happens. And I do think inherently there's some danger not having human oversight. I mean, and you see it in medicine, you see it in, you know, in other areas away from finance. I mean, yes, will artificial intelligence be better at radiology than a human might be? We think so. But a human second opinion might not be that bad, right? I mean, so it's a tool, it's a guide, it's an assistant. In some instances, it's going to enhance the process. In many instances, it's going to enhance the process. You know, are there going to be robotic arms that doctors use to engage in operations? You know, are we going to be in the financial services sector utilizing artificial intelligence to make investment decisions? Absolutely. But I can't imagine an environment where you zero out the employment base and everything just runs on its own. And so that's that, for a lot of reasons, I think, you know, humans have to be involved, not the least of which is I don't foresee an environment in which we don't do something productive during our days.
I also think that something that people do not think about with, or they have a misunderstanding of artificial intelligence, the future of it, that's going to have like a consciousness to do what it wants to do rather than what you pointed out, which is you're giving agency to a machine to make decisions. And I agree totally that you always need, you need that block. You need a person. You need someone there. And this is from like a safety perspective.
Yeah, 100%. If you go back to 2011, when we had the flash crash, right? That was a fat finger trade, as we like to call it, is an errant push button trade that led to a 1,000-point decline in the Dow in 30 minutes, and then a rebound almost all the way back to zero. And that all took place in a 30-minute period. We were down 300, down 1,000, then down 300 in an extremely short period. And that was largely the result of, you know, somebody making a mistake technologically. And it had to be sorted out. I mean, there was one stock that went to a penny. And so they negated all these trades where these stocks had gone down like 99%. And, you know, some people were buying this, a major name for one penny. By the end of the day, it was back to like $40, right? I mean, you would have gotten rich on that trade, right? And it was a huge technological error. And so I think, you know, cooler heads have to prevail. And so you can't give away the store, I don't think. I mean, as accurate as it ultimately might be, and as powerful as, for lack of a better description, the thought process might be with artificial intelligence, I do think it's still a risk to just, you know, walk away and put everything on, you know, on auto.
I absolutely agree. And I like seeing it from the ground level, this is something I don't think will ever change. Not well, hopefully will never change. All right, so we're talking about the future. I'm going to ask you to look into your crystal ball and tell me, what do you think will change in the next 5 years, in particular with Gen AI, as it improves?
So in the next 5 years, I certainly think that, you know, a lot of the tasks that are already being handled by AI are going to become even more dominated by that technology. So whether it's, you know, the more mundane tasks that go around office work in the legal community, in the healthcare community, writing up notes, sending out notes, you know, all the kind of scut work that needs to be done, but that absorbs a lot of people's time, that's easily going to be, in my mind, wiped out by AI, and in a rather, I think, elegant fashion as well. I mean, you know, for people who have played with the various tools that can, you know, translate your Word document into a much more elegant business plan or something like that in virtually no time with just a couple of keystrokes, that's going to happen over time, over the next 5 years. I also think, though, in fields like healthcare and investment management, you're going to get much more information that allows you to make better decisions, whether it's in patient care, drug development, or investment management. That's going to become increasingly useful, but also it's going to proliferate, I think, reasonably quickly once you get past ethical hurdles, once you get past compliance hurdles in the financial services business. I think you'll start to see a much more rapid adoption as those tools become more and more accurate. People will, you know, professionals will immediately move towards those and then really adopt them to enhance the outcomes of whatever it is they're doing. Again, that's healthcare, that's legal, that's financial services. It's a wide variety of industries, quite frankly. It's, you know, really anything that requires discovery. So energy, you know, the energy industry is going to be using it just as they did, you know, when they developed the ability to use computers to locate and sonar to locate oil deposits. You know, these types of things are going to happen with AI with much greater speed, much greater accuracy across a wide variety of fields. And I see within the next 5 years, will it dominate completely? No, humans will still be involved, but will it become totally integrated into the process of, in our case, investment management decisions? Absolutely. In healthcare, in diagnosing conditions, in developing drugs, identifying pathogens. I think all of that stuff's going to take place over the next 5 years, and it's going to become an increasingly important tool for a wide variety of industries during that period.
Are there any, and if there are, steps that the CTOs and CIOs can take today to future-proof their finance org? Like you said, everything's changing so quickly, and they have to be behind the ball. They have to be able to pivot and do what they need to do in order to stay like with the market. So is there anything that they can do right now that can help them at least put them on the path to future-proof themselves?
You have to just invest, right? I mean, there's no avoiding this, right? And there's going to be pain in the process too, because just like any other technological revolution, you're going to have to reorient your business almost entirely. So there will be jobs lost and jobs created, and you're going to have to understand which of those you're going to need to deal with first, and which of those you're going to spend more and invest more to get your people up to speed, so that those people who are going to utilize these technologies will be ready and able to use them. And so this is an age-old question, right? I mean, this goes back to the turn of the last century and the Industrial Revolution. You know, it's getting people up to speed and staying on top of the technological developments that take place. And you cannot be a Luddite in any industry, right? It's simply not possible. Someone will pass you by. And for big companies in particular, where it's sometimes very hard to turn, you know, a large ship, you have to be extremely nimble. So you have to create systems that, you know, prepare your people for change, that integrate those changes, you know, in a way in which they can consume them as part of their daily obligation, but also stay ahead of the curve. And then you just, in a certain sense, and this has always been true in business, it's almost a ruthless drive towards efficiency, right? I mean, you can't sit back and hope that it's not going to happen. We know it's going to happen, right? Once we saw the internet, we knew to a certain extent what was going to happen. We didn't know the extent to which it was going to happen, right? I mean, and it's ubiquitous now, and the companies that we thought might have failed during that period, Amazon, for instance, right? We thought, oh, online bookseller. Big deal. We got Barnes & Nobles. We got Borders. We, you know, who the hell cares? We're going to go into the bookstore all the time anyway. No, we're not. You know, so if you're not a CEO or you're not a CTO or any other C-suite executive who is not preparing for what's coming, you will be bypassed by your competitors. And you might be bypassed by a smaller competitor that you never heard of. And that's the real risk at the big company level. That's always a risk where you don't see it coming. You know, there are countless stories of people who said, oh, this is never going to work. And then the next thing you know, there's a small company that comes up and suddenly, you know, takes market share from you and puts you back on your heels. So future-proofing is staying informed. Future-proofing is learning these systems as best you can, understanding the benefits and the limitations of them and how they best augment, assist, and improve what you do. And if you're not doing that, you're going out of business. That's the simple story of business for as long as we've kind of, you know, had technologies that allow competitors to leapfrog you. That's really only been true for, you know, 120 some odd years, right? If you can go back to the Middle Ages and there were debates about whether you had cloth buttons or wood buttons, and that's how you had, you know, unions and guilds form. It's like, you know, no, we want the cloth buttons, we want the wood buttons. Those are really low, you know, low skill questions.
Yeah, and like with the ability of just like one visionary like Bezos anticipating that his company would be what it became today, you could have the ability for one person to totally change the industry is.
Yeah, and sometimes they don't even know what it is, right? I mean, he thought, hey, this is going to be cool. I'll be an online bookseller. And, you know, we never anticipated AWS out of that, right? I mean, nobody anticipated the cloud coming out of all of this stuff and you know, being able to upload all that data. And now that's integral to what AI does, right? I mean, so now that you have the cloud, or if you want to call it the galaxy at some point, you know, the ability to just consume almost infinite amounts of data was never really foreseen at the beginning of the internet. We didn't know when AI started. And listen, I mean, I know that IBM is among the first companies to ever have used the expression artificial intelligence in the 1950s. You know, you didn't even have connected computers at that point. And so now you have something that's entirely different that has infinite potential. And look, I'm not in the same, you know, camp as, and nor would I compare myself to people like Elon Musk or Peter Diamandis or others who are, you know, talking about the singularity and machines, you know, surpassing the intelligence of humans. There are certain things that I think that AI might never do as well as humans, mostly on the creative side. You know, I think because at the end of the day, all they're doing with that stuff is borrowing from other people's intellectual property and creating some variation on a theme. That's not creativity, right? So I think there's some limits there. But with respect to some of the things that we're talking about, I think that there are infinite possibilities that will enhance the prospects of business going forward. But again, you know, answer your question about future proofing. It's incumbent upon any executive to know as much about this as possible, whether they, you know, whether they fancy it or not, it's coming. And, you know, Lee Iacocca, I believe, wrote a book years ago called Lead, Follow, or Get Out of the Way. That's life, you know, in the business community.
Ron, this has genuinely been fantastic. God, we learned so much. I learned so much. But to all of you at home, thank you so much for being here. Please subscribe wherever you're listening or watching this podcast. You won't want to miss out on the cutting edge technology we're unpacking. See you soon.